Hi, welcome to this week's program. The housing and financial crash of 2008 still haunts many Americans today, and its effects set in motion new ways for those who are at or near retirement to survive in the new world created by that crisis. Thousands of Americans have become a new type of retiree, a mobile, dispersed class of gray nomads crisscrossing the country in search of part-time jobs and a safe place to park their RVs and experience a bit of adventure. All this while living on the economic margins of society. Now, every one of these itinerant seniors has a unique story about how their circumstances propelled them into a life of quasi-poverty, homelessness, and constant migration, with common threads of financial stress, overreaching debt, foreclosures, busted pensions, and blown savings, creating a nationwide phenomenon. The LA Times published an article recently called "Too Poor to Retire, Too Young to Die," and that documented the lives of several seniors living on the road in RVs, trying to stay one step ahead of the ever-looming money, health, and mechanical problems. You know, living on the edge has a way of galvanizing people's resourcefulness as they scrape together income from a variety of sources. After selling off their worldly possessions of no use on the road, they cobble together Social Security, pension funds from the government or military, and in some cases, Social Security disability income. They supplement all of this by picking up low-paying, low-skill, temporary, and seasonal jobs, while all the while paring down their costs to the bone by fervently clipping coupons and resorting to ultra-cheap or free meals. Basically, they're doing whatever it takes to survive. Seasonal work is scattered throughout the country, and many gray nomads drive hundreds or thousands of miles to follow a string of temporary gigs. The LA Times describes grinding minimum wage work like cleaning bathrooms at campgrounds, harvesting vegetables, selling Christmas trees, door-to-door sales, and mall kiosk jobs. Ironically, many of these seniors had interesting and far more highly esteemed careers earlier in life, but unexpected events or a combination of ageism, erratic work history, and health issues all conspired to limit their opportunities in old age. Along with debt, one of the biggest challenges facing non-retired seniors is the threat of emergency costs, whether it's health care or vehicle repairs or some other type of misfortune. Something as simple as a routine bill from the DMV can provoke a financial crisis that forces them to decide between a prescription copay and living on rice and beans for a few weeks. Let's take a closer look at the income side of the equation for people with little or no savings. Social Security pays out an average of $1,200 a month. That's $14,400 a year. That's just a few thousand dollars above the official poverty line. About one half of all single people and one quarter of married couples depend on Social Security for 90% of their income. The reason it's better for couples is that they have an advantage of saving money by sharing expenses. So this puts single women of retirement age at the most risk for poverty. The AARP issued a report stating that 3 out of 5 households headed by someone over the age of 50 had no retirement savings at all. That adds up to millions of people living month to month and hand to mouth on that one check. Even with a paid-off home, the expenses of upkeep, insurance, and taxes and utilities are still a major burden on less than $15,000 a year. And this doesn't even begin to get into other mandatory expenses like health care and food. Even if these individuals can qualify for federal assistance, medicine and food insecurity are still daunting problems for many. Now, retirement seniors who are lucky enough to receive pensions or payouts from their 401k or IRAs are substantially better off than those living exclusively on a Social Security check. That said, even if we push the theoretical income closer to $25,000 a year, this doesn't exactly put you on easy street. So, how do you figure out how much money you'll need in order to enjoy a comfortable retirement, or at least one that's similar to the lifestyle you've been accustomed to while working? Some retirement planning experts say that you'll want to replace 85% of the income you made while working. So that's a number you can think about. There are many paths to reaching this target, but simple scenarios depend on saving 15% of your income per year for 4 decades. And that's difficult for many, especially when it forces you to live in a more austere life for those decades. Of course, figuring out how much you'll need at retirement is more complicated, but a competent, certified financial planner can work with you on this. In any case, you not only need to save this money, but you need to invest in long-term assets like home equity or a diverse portfolio of stocks, and when rates get back to normal levels, high-yield savings accounts. See my post on our website, stevepomerantz.com, for my segment entitled To Have and Have Not, How to Build Wealth with Stocks. I think that'll give you a good starter. Whatever romance there might seem to be with the gray nomad life, roaming around the country in your golden years, experiencing new towns and people of all walks of life, there's a right way and a wrong way to make this happen. The wrong way is by necessity, driven by the fear of running out of options and always being one surprise away from disaster. The right way is with the luxury of choice. The point is that while it's possible to live on $14,000 or $25,000 a year, and that's proven by the millions who do live on this budget, the stress of being one health or emergency away from poverty is something none of us would want for ourselves or our loved ones. So, take heed and think about your future. This week on the On the Money Minute, 5 steps to better credit. Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. It's a classic catch-22. You've got to have credit to get credit. So where do you start? With step 1 in my 5-step guide to building a strong credit record. But it's not enough just to establish a credit report. When you get credit, it's important to follow these key steps to net the best possible score. Make your payments as soon as you get your bill. If you push it to the due date, any little snag could cause you to be late, no internet access, ran out of stamps, got lost in the mail. Making your payments on time is one of the main factors that determine your credit score. A single missed payment can drag down your score, and the incident can stay on your record for up to 7 years. Want more on the money? Don't forget to follow us at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Or facebook.com/The Steve Pomerantz Show. You've all heard of Morningstar, I'm sure, and you may have heard of my next guest. Her name is Christine Benz. Christine is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance and author of 30-Minute Money Solutions, a step-by-step guide to managing your finances, and the Morningstar Guide to Mutual Funds. Welcome back to the show, Christine.
Hi, Steve. Always great to be here.
You wrote an article, 21 Days to Improve Your Financial Life. I just have one question. Can I lose weight at the same time?
You can try. Did you have a salad for lunch?
Oh, maybe. Maybe that's a good idea. So this is each day for the next 3 weeks, weekends included. And I want to go through some of the daily activities that you should concentrate on in order to get your financial affairs in order. So let's start with week number one. You write, hit the ground running. Take us through that.
Yeah, we were trying to put forth a lot of baseline type of tasks, the stuff that you need to get done before you can get into the nitty-gritty of investing. So we covered topics like assessing your insurance needs, creating a budget, checking your cash flows. So even before you create a budget, it's valuable to take a look at where your money is going on an ongoing basis. We talked readers through calculating net worth. And we have, along with a lot of these tasks, some worksheets that people can use.
Great.
So they can print them out and work on them and document their own information.
I think a lot of people are afraid to get this process started, or they're overwhelmed by, maybe they think there's a lot of math involved. But this stuff is actually pretty easy, right?
It really is. It's quite basic. The idea is to just kind of find your baseline before you can move forward with more sophisticated financial planning tasks.
Yeah.
So see how you're doing on kind of covering some of the basic goals and also making sure that you are addressing potential risk factors for your household. So I do think insurance, for example, is a biggie. People need to make sure that they are insuring against the big risks before they can even get into investing.
Yeah, good point. So day one, you calculate your net worth. You add up all of your savings, all of your investments. You kind of put an estimate on your house if you own a home. And then you subtract any debt that you may have. Maybe you have a mortgage. Maybe you have some credit card debt. If you own your cars, you can put them in there. If you have some jewelry or whatever it is, put it in there. Subtract out any debt and you come up with your net worth. It's really a nice number to know because you can kind of follow that year after year and to see if you're staying on track to increase your net worth. Yeah, so I think day one, net worth. Day two, assess your cash flows and create a budget. We're not straining anybody here, I noticed. You're not asking them to do two things in one day.
No, and the good news is too, regarding budgeting and tracking cash flows, there are a lot of great apps to help you do that right now. So whether people are using Mint.com or some other budgeting software, maybe using Quicken to track their household expenses, there's technology that can make this job easier for you. Or you can do it the pen and paper way or just keep some running notes on your cell phone.
Yeah. Yeah, my mantra is know what you own.
Right.
And that's where you've got to start. You got to know what you're doing. Okay, week number two, we're graduating from salads. Maybe we're adding a little more protein. I'm not exactly sure. So you write, ensure that your investments align with your goals. What does that mean?
Well, it's to take stock of your goals, for one thing, take stock of your financial goals, and then make sure that to the extent that you have investments, that you have allocated them properly so that you're not taking too much risk. Say if you plan to buy a house within the next 2 years and you're amassing a down payment, well, that's money that you really don't want to have invested in stock, even though stocks have certainly beat the safer stuff recently. Mm-hmm. So taking a look at your goals and then making sure that your investments are appropriately allocated, that you're not taking too much risk given the proximity of a given goal. For retirement, if you're not planning to retire for another 35 years, well, there you certainly would want to have the bulk of your portfolio in stocks.
Exactly. Or even if you are retired and, you know, you're probably going to live another 20, 25 years, if all goes well, maybe 30, maybe more.
Right.
You've got to remember that these assets have to grow, have to keep pace with inflation, and you can't just go completely under the cover and hide from risk. You've got to take some kind of calculated risk and think long term. I mean, some clients say to me, you know, I don't even buy green bananas, you know, because, you know, I'm not really thinking about the future here. But also another idea, there used to be this rule of thumb where you would take 100 and then subtract your age.
Right.
And the difference would be how much you'd have in stocks. Now, I really do not believe in that whatsoever. But someone mentioned something that actually kind of changed my thinking the other day. And that was these days, maybe your age shouldn't be 100. Maybe it should be 120.
Right.
Minus your age. And that, okay, so, you know, maybe we just are underestimating modern science and our ability to live longer. We'll see about that. Okay. So.
Yeah, no, I think those rules of thumb can be a decent starting point, but I'm with you. More like 110, 120 minus your age is a reasonable equity allocation.
Yeah. Okay. So we were talking about days eight. Create an investment policy statement. Oh boy, that sounds like something an advisor would put together. How does a small investor create an investment policy statement?
Right, and advisors certainly do. But as an investor, you're putting together an investment policy statement to just say, here's what I'm doing. Here's the key goals of my plan. Here is the asset allocation that I plan to stick to, and here's how it might change over time. There are three types of investments that I'm going to use to populate my plan. And importantly, I think one of the key reasons to create one of these investment policy statements is to say how often you're going to check up on the plan and what will be triggers for any changes. So, you know, especially when the market starts going down, many investors are inclined to get in there and start fiddling around. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they regret those changes they've made at those market inflection points. Taking the time to document your investment policy in one of these statements, I think, tends to enforce a little bit the discipline. If you've written it down, you're more likely to stick with the program than override it if you're feeling spooked by what's going on in the market.
You know, I think a powerful thing to write down would be the timing of your goals. What goals are short term? Let's say you mentioned buying a house, let's say within a year or something like that. The intermediate term goals, maybe you've got kids that are, you know, 13 or 14 years old and you're thinking 5 years for them. That's an intermediate term goal, you know, to start college. Oh, and then you have your long-term goals. And then you can pick the appropriate investments for those different time goals. You know, that is incredibly powerful. So let's say you've got a long-term goal, market goes down, you hate the idea, it makes you ill, but you go, you know what? I mean, this is 20, 30 years from now I'm talking about. Let it ride, and you can kind of leave it alone. And you know that your money for the short term that you may need is sitting somewhere else and somewhere safe. That's very powerful.
I think so, too. In fact, I remember during the financial crisis in 2008, everything was going down, as everyone remembers. And I had a family member who was very spooked by what was going on with her account balance. She had seen it nicely plump up, and then she was watching it fall to the ground. And the one thing that seemed to get through to her was me saying, are you retiring anytime soon? And at the time, I think she was in her 40s, so the answer was no.
Right.
And so she was able to kind of see, well, I don't need this money right now. I can let this ride with the knowledge that stocks over time do tend to outperform other asset classes.
That's right. It takes a little bit of belief. Let's go to week three. We've added some bread into our into our diet a little bit, not too much though. Take a look forward up to and into your own retirement. Let's see. Craft a strategy for generating cash flows in retirement. So day 15, simplify your investment plan. Day 16, formulate a strategy for retirement portfolio withdrawals. We've got a minute left. Take us through some of that.
Well, I focus a lot on this topic of retirement portfolio withdrawals. I work a lot on what's called the bucket approach to retirement portfolio planning. And the fact is, yields are so low right now that retirees don't know where to go to generate cash flow from their portfolios. Mm-hmm. So I think this bucket strategy can be a way to visualize on an ongoing basis how you can generate cash from your portfolio. And that does mean periodically selling things or selling pieces of things that have gone up a lot. Mm-hmm. So my advice to retirees is be flexible about where you go for cash on an ongoing basis. Income might get you part of the way there, but be willing to rebalance your portfolio, scale back on the risky stuff, and use the proceeds from those sales to help meet your living expenses.
Very good. My guest, Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. Don't forget to go to Morningstar.com and put in Christine Benz's name, and she will appear, and all of our articles will be there to hear this interview again and to sign up for our weekly update of what's going on our site and the new topics that we're introducing every single week. Don't forget to go to StevePomerantz.com. Thanks, Christine.
Thank you, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. My next guest has spent much of his professional life reporting and writing on economics and helping people make the most of their money. He's currently senior economics contributor at Marketplace, which is American Public Media's nationally syndicated public radio business show. And you know, I really enjoy Chris's thinking regarding the real business of retirement. He turns the doom and gloomers on their head and really helps us understand what the real path is that anyone can take to live their one best life. His latest venture is his Unretirement podcast. You may remember or know him from his book, Unretirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work. And we'll give you the web address a little bit later in the show. But first, I want to welcome Chris Farrell to our show. Hi, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Hey, you know, I listened to the podcasts and really enjoyed them. Tell us a few stories from the interviews and also some of the listeners' questions that you have addressed.
Yes, so the stories are, I think, really compelling. And it's people rethinking, reimagining the second half of life. And they're vibrant, they want to keep working, but not necessarily full-time. Although some of the people that we portrayed, they've jumped from one full-time job into another full-time job. But it's just thinking about meaning and money, that as we get older, there's still this need to earn an income, but you also, what you're doing, you don't just want to be working to pay the bills, and you don't want to do that at any point in your life, but it's, particularly as you get older, it's about, you know, what's my legacy? How do I make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the people that we interviewed was Sylvia, and Sylvia had been a long time public relations, crisis management, in the crisis management business, and then on the side, she had this business working with sustainable agricultural firms, helping them with some of their marketing. And she and her husband started talking about what do we want to do next. And the concept of stewardship was really important to them. So they did what I think, and this is one of the fun things, I imagine you come across this, they found what they really love to do, and I can't imagine anything worse. They became small farmers. And it's an 80-acre farm in Wisconsin. It's grass-fed beef. It's sustainable. And they built a house that is built into the land, and it uses hardly any energy. I mean, it's really wonderful. And you're taking that concept of stewardship really seriously. Now, the reason why I say it's not for me is my idea of a nice Sunday is getting up in the morning, having a cup of coffee, reading the New York Times. And if you spend any time on a farm, you realize this is a lot of work.
Yeah, you know, it's the same thing that I think when I walk into a restaurant and I see all of the work and I know how much time restaurateurs spend in their business. And I go, you know, I just would never want to do that. But people have the passion for it. And owning a farm, it's a 24/7 proposition.
It is. And then we'll be putting out soon a story. A woman that we met, she's 58. She had been a professional nanny and doesn't have a college education. But she said, you know, you make good money as a professional nanny. But in her late 50s, she was burned out on it, tired of it. It was hard on her body. And so it really opened my eyes. I never imagined, but she's becoming a quilting instructor, a certified quilting instructor.
Quilting.
She'll make about the same amount of money as she did as a professional nanny. But part of what I like about what she's doing and, you know, looking ahead as she gets older is that quilting's in a boom. And she and her husband can travel around the country and she'll teach classes. And it, her description is, he's going to go off fishing, and she's going to go teach classes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is their unretirement. They need to have an income. It's something she loves doing. It's a community that is growing. It's all part of this makers community, this craft community. And so there's a lot of cleverness out there about what people are thinking to do in the second half of life.
Well, there's independent thinking. There's original thinking. What are some of the things that people should do if they, you know, they're over 50 and they get laid off? I mean, that's a shock to the system.
It's a real shock to the system. And the first podcast was Tanae, and she was unexpectedly laid off, just as you said, at age 56. And she had a lot of friends, and friends are important. And she had a wonderful friend who happened to own a restaurant and said, let's go, let's get out of town. They got in the car, they drove to Seattle where she had a vacation home. And this friend, when they got there, handed her the keys to the home and said, I'll be back in 3 weeks. There's several hundred bottles of wine in the apartment. And she started thinking and regenerating herself. And so what she decided to become is a social entrepreneur, working with people in low-income, particularly African-American communities, about gathering assets, about building some wealth so they can have some independent freedom. And she's on her journey. She's not there yet. She got some additional education. She's creating her own consulting firm. But the thing that I took away from my conversation with her was two things. One is she really tapped into her network of friends. What do you think I should be doing? What do you think I would be good at? Do you have somebody that I should talk to, an informational interview? Because the thing is, if you're an older, experienced worker and you are unexpectedly laid off, let's say in your late 50s or early 60s, your most valuable asset, not your retirement savings plan, it's not your home, your most valuable asset is the network of people you know. Because they know who you are. They know what you can do. They don't care what your age is. And so that was one of the things that she did that I thought was extremely important. The other thing that she did is she said, you know, she had to let go of certain things. So to pay some bills, she's working at Trader Joe's, and she likes it and has a retirement savings plan, has a health care plan. You know, she's working there part-time. It's helping her meet the bills. It's not a long-term commitment, but she said, you know, needed to make some money in order to get closer to doing my dream. And when I was in my early 50s, if you had said to me, I'm going to be working in a grocery store, which is what I did in high school, I'd be saying, no, I'm not going to do that. Right. I'm not that kind of person anymore. And now what she's doing is she's saying, you know what? It's help paying the bills. I like my colleagues. I have my dream. And so I'm making a little money and I know where I'm going. So I think it's this combination of, you know, really trying to realize what it is you want to do next, and then how do you get there?
My guest is Chris Farrell, and his latest venture is the Unretirement Podcast, based on the themes of his book, Unretirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work. You know, one of your listeners asked the question, how can a 60-year-old continue to find work in a field that is dominated by young people?
You know, this is something that a lot of us, you know, as we age, we're going to face more and more. And one of the things, and I'm curious what you think, because one of the things that comes out of that is, you know, if you try and go stay in your field, or you try and walk through the door, or you try and use your resume, all the kind of traditional ways that we think about getting a job, it's going to be really hard.
Yeah.
So you really do two things. One, as I said, it's the network, and it's tapping into your network, because they don't care about your age. They know you have something to offer, and they know your character. And so, you know, more than 50% of all jobs come through a network, that third degree of separation. I think the other thing is to think about how can I transfer my skills. So journalism is a declining business, but journalists know how to write. Journalists know how to tell a story. Museums are, storytelling is becoming an extremely important part of the museum industry. You know, there's all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So it's taking whatever your skill is in this industry that's dominated by young people, or in an industry that may be declining, and looking around and saying, okay, where else could I take my skills?
I think you make a very good example in journalism. I think that's a very good way, because you have a talent. It's a skill as well, of course, and a skill built out over many years. And this transfers to all of us who have done work for many years in the same field. I'm a financial planner. I've had this radio show for over 15 years. So those skills are transferable. If you're going to compete directly with someone who's younger, they're not really going to have your skills. They're going to have other skills. So you need to kind of do an end around and figure out who you are and really kind of invent your own life in a sense.
That's right. And I met some people like in the financial planning industry, and they reach a point where, you know, they go down to a few favorite clients. I mean, they're clients, but they're people that they just really like, they enjoy, they've known for a long period of time. And then one person I met, you know, that's what they did. And they get paid a little bit of money, but not much. But they teach financial literacy at a center that's mostly working with immigrants, newcomers to the country, and teaching about checking accounts and savings accounts and credit cards and all these kinds of things. And, you know, it's a good life.
So the bottom line is you want to discover your own second life, your own second career, and the money part of it. You need to obviously change some things. If you haven't saved an appropriate amount of money, you need to retailor your life to fit your current situation. But you can have a very, very fulfilling life. Actually, in some terms, if all you're thinking about is money your whole life, and now you don't have to do that anymore, it could be quite a relief and quite liberating.
It can be very liberating. And one of the things that I've learned as I've been talking to people is there is a strong desire for meaning and money, or, you know, a purpose and a paycheck. But a lot of people, they reach their late 50s, their early 60s, and it's like, well, what is that? What is it that I want to be doing? And I think this is a big part of retirement planning, thinking about and giving yourself the time to think about what is it that I want to do next.
Yeah.
And one of the things that many people do that's really fruitful, doesn't work for everybody, but is look at your volunteer activities. And start looking at those volunteer activities and the people you're meeting volunteering a slightly different way. I believe in this cause. You would be volunteering if you didn't believe in the cause. Would I like to work with this organization? Could I help them out? Do I have some skills? Not just being the volunteer, which is a wonderful thing to do, but do I have some skills, marketing skills, finance skills, storytelling skills, that this organization could use? And so one way to sort of plan for your retirement is to look at your volunteering activities and say, wow, could I do this as a job? You're going to make less money. Absolutely. No question about that, particularly if you want a flexible schedule or to go part-time, but you'll still be making income. And if you volunteer, you probably do believe in that cause or that issue.
Sure. My guest is Chris Farrell. Chris, what's the best way for people to find your new podcast?
So they can go to the website unretirement.fm, and that's our website, or they can go to iTunes and just go to the podcast section of iTunes and type in unretirement, and it will pop up.
Okay, it's a very good resource for all of you who are in this situation or starting to think in this way. Chris, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. It's a real pleasure.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in sunny Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Hey, I have a question for you. Have you ever had anybody that you know or heard about anybody you know who bought a house with Bitcoin?
No. Seeing that I barely know what it is, I've heard what it is.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
But I know it's rumored out there that, will that be a possibility? I don't know.
I don't know if it's possible, but sure enough, Bitcoin is got everybody's attention these days. Now, Bitcoin is a digital currency, meaning it's basically created from a computer. It's bits and bytes. It doesn't really have anything behind it, per se. It doesn't have the strength of an economy behind it, and so on.
No gold behind it.
No gold, nothing. There's really nothing behind it. Really, one of the main features of Bitcoin is that there's a limited quantity because they're not generally easy to make. You can make them slowly. So one of the facets of a currency is this idea that, hey, if the government continues to print its money, print, then it's going to lose its value and will create inflation over time. But if you can control the quantity of money out there, then some people think that it's a better kind of currency. Very, very controversial, very, very volatile. But you have your believers and your disbelievers. For those who believe in it, generally they love being in the digital arena where they feel they can kind of hide from governmental prying eyes.
Right, right.
Pretty interesting.
There's something here where somebody stockpiled several million dollars worth of this currency. It's also the same that, you know, they stockpile their food.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, you know, the other thing too, of course, is that the price of Bitcoin has skyrocketed from, you know, practically next to nothing 5 years ago to about $4,000 per coin.
Wow.
And when you know, if you started off with $1,000 in it, you've made so much money. It's kind of obscene. So to stockpile millions of dollars when they probably only initially cost you a couple thousand, I don't know if that's impressive or not. But the bottom line basically is that there are a lot of people out there, people that I respect, that are saying Bitcoin is nothing more than a bubble. As a matter of fact, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, who is someone I respect quite greatly, said it was absolutely a worthless currency, absolutely a bubble. And he said that anybody in his company that traded it would be immediately fired So be very, very careful out there. I'm not saying Bitcoin is or isn't. I don't think I'm smart enough to know. It's a very, very early. But if someone wants to buy your house with Bitcoin,
don't come to me.
my advice is make sure that the day they pay you is the day you can actually sell them and convert them back into dollars.
Okay. Right.
That's my sentiment on that. All right. So let's get to some other questions here. I have a question for you here, Terry. Why should buyers think twice about asking sellers to make repairs to the home for defective items that were discovered during the inspection? I love when you tell us this story.
I'll give you an example. Just recently, I went to contract back in May and we're closing in October. So there's a long period of time. The buyer asked the seller to take care of certain items, including roof leaks. So it sounded like a great idea because the buyer's thinking, well, the seller should take care of these items right away. It'll be, you know, 4 months before we close, get the roof leaks fixed. But what happened is the seller didn't take care of the roof leaks until just recent. So now we've had a hurricane come through. The situation's a lot worse.
Wow.
Wasn't done right. Done by an unlicensed roofer.
Yeah.
So it's just made the situation a lot worse. The buyer's saying, I'm not going to buy this house. There's no warranty by this unlicensed roofer because it wasn't spelled out clear enough, you know, that it had to be licensed, insured, warranties transferable. You know, and when you're dealing with a higher end property and people in respectable professions, you would think they would do the right thing and hire a professional roofing company that's licensed and insured to do work on the house.
You know what this reminds me of, if I may interrupt here really quickly?
Sure.
So when you lease a car, you have to return the car with tires with a certain amount of tread.
Right.
Right? It has to have like 3/16. And Erica, my producer, is giving me a weird look like, where are you going with this? And so, you know, let's face it, you know, you wait until the very last minute. Your tread is way down. You've got to turn the car back in. So do you go out and buy a whole new set of tires, brand spanking new, and give the new owner of that lease,
yeah,
you know,
that's basically
40,000 miles? No, you go to the place up the street and you look for the same kind of tire and you look for the tread that's just there at the 3/32. And that's what you put on the car. Not that I've ever done that, mind you. I'm not sure
I'm glad you're sharing that idea because I like it.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's the same kind of concept. So, you know,
yeah,
when deals fall apart and there's issues, it always comes down to the repairs. It's so much easier just to take credits and not get involved having sellers make repairs.
You want control over the process. I think that's the bottom line.
Right.
You give up control. And it's like we did a segment a few weeks ago on flippers, buying a house from a flipper. You know, there isn't a lot of incentive for them to put in the best stuff and get the best, you know, result because, you know, they've got some economic issues that they have to deal with in terms of how much they bought it for, how much they have to pay to fix it up, and then how much they have to sell it for. So be careful when you're buying from flippers. And in this case, maybe it's not such a great idea to let the seller make the repairs. We are out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks for joining us, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And to hear more about these issues and to hear Terry's story as much as you would like, we all love to hear her, don't forget to go to the website, which is stevepomerantz.com. StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Dr. Bud Labatin is a physician and investor who has written books related to value investing and making smarter decisions. I've read a number of his books, and I've had him on the show in the past to describe the art of investing. His latest book is Sports and Stocks, Quality Business Investing. Also, from time to time, I'll ask Bud to analyze some companies that I'm thinking about. Welcome back to the show, Bud.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So today we're going to talk about the art and science of individual investing. But my first question is kind of a broader question.
Sure.
In a world of index investing where everybody's going what they call passive, and there's this sense that, you know, it's very hard to beat the basic indexes, why would anyone try their hand at individual stock picking?
Well, I agree with you that the population of individual stock pickers is probably smaller than one would think. I think it takes an individual who has a passion and an interest for looking into the details and who enjoys looking at the whole business.
Yeah, some people feel more comfortable investing in singular companies that they can kind of, in a sense, feel a tangible relationship to.
Yes.
As opposed to an index, which, you know, again, doesn't seem to have this quality of tangibility. And also, I feel, though I do a lot of passive investing, index investing myself and for clients, sometimes it's just nice to know, especially in a market decline, the name, you know, that you're investing in, whether it's, and I'm just picking this out of the air, you know, a Disney or a Procter & Gamble, something that feels like, you know, it's not going to disappear in a bad recession or the like. So let's get into this idea of investing in individual stocks. Your first tenet is to find high quality bargains. What does that actually mean?
It means to find a business that has enduring qualities. I know in our last interview, we talked about the philosophy of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and your listeners can review that one. But getting back to what you said about this is not for everybody, and it does take time, training, and temperament. If a person doesn't have the time, training, and temperament, they should leave it up to investment professionals like yourself.
Right, or just do some passive investing like Warren Buffett says, right?
Right.
Okay, so you're trying to find high-quality bargains.
Bargains.
What is the definition of a high-quality stock? I mean, we hear about blue chip. We kind of know, but what does it mean to you?
To me, in one of the chapters, chapter 7 of Sports and Stocks, I simplified it so that it would keep the readers out of bad and mediocre businesses. So I'll just read those 4 points to you, Steve.
Okay.
One is find a business that is producing positive free cash flow, or FCF, and stay away from these startups that are not yet producing positive free cash flow. The second thing is find a business that's producing a net profit margin greater than 10%. Buffett likes 15% and higher. But I think if you can at least eliminate the ones under 10% profit margin, you can filter out a lot of bad and mediocre businesses.
Okay.
The third one is look for a business that has a debt to equity ratio less than 2-to-1. Now, there are some exceptions to this rule because the debt-to-equity ratio can be a tricky one because young companies that are financed mainly by equity, they're going to appear as if they have hardly any debt because no one will loan them money.
Yeah.
On the flip side, a great company like Coca-Cola can handle a little bit more debt because it's got a steady stream of free cash flow.
Yeah.
But in general, you want to keep that debt-to-equity ratio less than 2-to-1.
I mean, if you were a banker.
Uh-huh. Sure.
And you are going to be lending a company money, you would want to see whether their earnings and cash flow were steady or they were cyclical? And because it would really matter. If you've got steady income like a Coca-Cola or something, they can take on more debt. And as a banker, you can afford to lend them more because you feel safer with regards to the ability of getting your interest paid and you're getting your money back. If it's a company that's very cyclical and does poorly in bad economic times, I think you're going to want a lower debt-to-equity ratio. Would that be accurate?
That's very accurate. That's exactly correct. And just to add on to what you said there, during these economic times, while the interest rates are still low, I believe Coca-Cola is slightly above that too. I think it's at about 2.3 or 2.4. Mm-hmm. But item number four on the list is you want a company that's producing a return on equity greater than 10%. And of course, higher than that is even better.
Yeah. So it's return on equity, folks, means if you look at the book value of a company, take all the assets minus all the liabilities, and you end up with really kind of what the stockholder owns, the book value. And then you look at the earnings and you kind of figure out the ratio. Well, what is the earnings relative to that book value? That's what he's talking about when he says, you know, the return on equity.
Right.
Because as a stockholder, that's really what matters, is what you as a stockholder are getting relative to the investment that you've made. Now, Bud, you have written this book, Sports and Stocks, Quality Business Investing. So you've really used the sports as a great metaphor for investing. So let's start with the first sport that you write about, and that's football.
Yes.
Why is football a good analogy to successful investing?
Well, football, for fans of football who know that the idea of winning football is based on three major areas: offense, defense, and special teams. Now, in this context, I'm talking about offense, defense, and special situations. And in the book, I talk about some of the things that the Chicago Bears have done. And also, I talk about the role of the special teams and the special situations. I just wanted to make people aware that there are winning ideas in sports that can relate to winning ideas in investing. And the major point there is preparation, knowledge of the game, knowing how to deal with wins and losses, the mental toughness, the emotionality of the game. And our primary goal, as you so rightly said earlier, is to find a high-quality business, HQB.
Yeah. All right. So football is kind of your basic, your passing, your running play, your pass play, your kicking.
Mm-hmm.
The second chapter, though, is basketball. How does basketball relate? If you love basketball and you understand how teams work, how can you then make that transfer to the idea of investing successfully?
In basketball, we can look at different aspects. We can look at it from the player's point of view, from the coach's point of view, and also from the organizational point of view. And one of the basketball players I mentioned in there is the famous Laker player, Jerry West, who was mentally tough. He constantly worked on learning and improving his game. As a young player, he was more of a penetrator, but as an older player, he started to develop his outside shot. He was a great team player, and he was also a very unselfish player. Mm-hmm. So what I was trying to relate to the readers is that in investing, we can learn a lot on our own. But just like I have learned from you, and hopefully you've learned a few things from me, there's a knowledge sharing there that if you're going to do this as an individual, you kind of have to have the passion for continuous learning.
I think the one thing about basketball, too, is you must have the ability to make quick decisions. And I know that a great investor, once knowing all the rules, knowing how things work, how, and I guess in basketball, you know, how the other team is setting up,
mm-hmm.
what your strategy is, but seeing opportunity and being able to act on it very quickly. I know Warren Buffett does that from time to time, and so do other great investors. So this ability—
You brought up a good point there. Yeah, that's a great point, because in sports, they have to make instantaneous decisions, mm-hmm. whereas in value investing, you can take the time and do the preliminaries, you can go through the four filters, and then you can do that, what one book calls the second level thinking. I think Daniel Kahneman, in his book about behavioral finance, called it slow thinking. You have fast thinking, and then you also have slow thinking.
Slow thinking, yeah. My guest is Dr. Bud Labatan. The book is Sports and Stocks, Quality Business Investing. I think one of the best metaphors, and I use this all the time when I'm talking about investing, is the baseball metaphor. I'm going to steal a little bit of your thunder here. Warren Buffett always talks about the ability to stand at the plate when you're investing and not to be subject to any balls or strikes, to just be able to stand there and receive pitch after pitch until you get that one pitch.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it the fat pitch, where you just know it's the sweetest thing that you can hit and that ball is going to be hit out of the park. And he waits and waits. The patient investor waits for the fat pitch.
Oh, exactly. You're referring to him talking about Ted Williams in his book, The Science of Hitting,
yeah,
where you wait just for that right pitch. And that's the beauty of value investing, is that you don't have to swing right away. You can take your time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, baseball, we've got, what about the coaching aspect of sports? That's incredibly important. How does that relate to being a successful investor?
The coaching, I sort of divided that into the external coach and the internal coach. The external coach, you can learn from reading, from listening to your podcast, Steve, from other documentaries, and also mentors. Charlie Munger refers to them as the wise dead, people who have already passed on.
The wise dead.
Yeah, but have left a legacy of,
yeah.
You know, useful thought.
Uh-huh.
So that encompasses the whole external coaching.
Mm-hmm.
The internal coach that I refer to is the desire and passion to do your homework and try to look at these things from different angles and try to teach yourself more things.
You know, listeners, if any questions come to mind, don't forget that you can write in your questions to us at stevepomerantz.com. You can, of course, hear this interview again. You can see a transcript or a summary about this interview and find out more about Bud's book. The book is Sports and Stocks, Quality Business Investing. Earlier, Bud, we talked about mental toughness. I was thinking about the game of golf,
mm-hmm,
in particular. A lot of great players, great technical players in the game of golf, but that particular sport seems to require a tremendous amount of mental toughness. What do you think about that?
You know, I wish I had added a chapter on golf, but I remember one of my book reviewers mentioned golf, and I agree with you that it does take discipline. And there's also, I think in golf as well as investing, one should have a certain degree of calmness. I used to play with a fellow who was physically gifted, and he was well-trained, and he had a beautiful swing. And you would think that this guy could have been a professional golfer, but every hole after the first hole, he would be so critical on himself,
yeah,
that his game would just deteriorate. And by the time we got to the 18th hole, he had basically torn himself apart mentally.
Yeah.
So there's a certain degree of framing and calmness.
Yeah.
And anyone who gets into this should enjoy the process.
Well, you know, the thing about a game, especially for amateurs, is, you know, you play the game of golf, you play football, so, you know, you should play.
Mm-hmm.
You should have fun,
yeah,
and play, and it shouldn't be quite so serious. You know, the fact with golf, though, is at the very end, when we're talking about high-level professional golf, you get to the 17th hole, it's the last round of the day, everything is at stake. I mean, that's really where you see the real mental toughness coming out. And investing, you do need a lot of mental toughness. Investing is simple, but it's not easy. And there's a lot of times your thesis that you kind of feel is right and you know is right and you've done all the math and you've checked and checked and checked, and yet the investment is still going against you.
Let me add two things to what you're saying there, Steve. On that mental toughness chapter, I also talk a little bit about mental flexibility and the ability to keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also talk about mental efficiency, which is sort of like time management. So that chapter title is kind of a misnomer or misheading. But I think if folks read the book or listen to the audiobook that's coming from audible.com, they'll kind of get the idea that hopefully it will stimulate them to look at it from different mental aspects.
Yeah, so this is a book that I recommend. I think it's a book that will take you through these first steps. And plus, there's some really good examples of individual stocks and how to think about them, and to give you kind of a springboard to dig deeper. And, you know, Dr. Labatin's books will do just that. The Four Filters is an excellent one on how to think about and structure the idea of how to invest in stocks. And if we've raised more questions than we've answered, don't forget that you can hear this interview again by coming to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. And you know, if you want to get these and more informative interviews straight to your inbox, subscribe to our weekly update. Again, that's stevepomerantz.com. Bud Labatin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve, and I hope your listeners find this both entertaining, stimulating, and profitable to them.
Gray, quiet and tired and mean, looking at a worried scene. I tried to make you mad at me over the phone. Red eyes and fires and signs, I'm taken by a nursery rhyme. I wanna make a ray of sunshine.
This week on the On the Money Minute, 5 steps to better credit. Hi, this is Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. Better to establish and build a credit report for yourself now before you need to borrow money. This will take some time. In order to have a credit score, you must have had credit for at least 6 months with at least one of your accounts updated and reported within the past 6 months. Don't max out your credit cards. Keep your credit card use to less than 30% of your credit limits. So if your card carries a $500 limit, try to keep your spending below $150, even on a secured credit card. Not only will the strategy help you get the best possible rates, it can help you avoid getting in over your head in debt. I'll get into that more tomorrow. For now, I'm Steve Pomerantz. Want more On the Money? Don't forget to follow us at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com, or facebook.com/The Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on The Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.